I want it to be more accessible to people because it goes against the grain of our society, which is to be reflective, to try to be as honest with yourself as possible, which is both scary and enlivening. To develop that kind of playful curiosity you had as a child, use your imagination, to develop a very deep, special relationship with someone that's unlike any other relationship you'll have in your life.
Welcome to the Ruth Stone House podcast. I'm Bianca Stone. And I'm talking today with Nathan Rice, a licensed psychotherapist, certified psychoanalyst, and clinical supervisor with a private practice in New York City. He also happens to be a lover of poetry and, like myself, is curious about the crossovers between poetry and therapy. So, Nathan, welcome and thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. So we came together through Twitter, and you have had some really amazing posts, which I find highly relevant to this discussion. One recently is a Robert Frost quote, "A poem," and you wrote in brackets, "therapy, begins with a lump in the throat, a sense of wrong, a homesickness, a lovesickness. It is a reaching out toward expression, an effort to find fulfillment. A complete poem is one where an emotion finds the thought and the thought finds the words." To start, tell me a little bit about how you came to be a therapist, study psychology, and when poetry came into the picture, or if it was always there.
Yeah. I started psychoanalysis because I didn't feel like I had a voice. On my voice. On myself silent in conversations and not able to speak or voice things that I was thinking or feeling, and leaving interactions very feeling alienated and alone.
The therapist is in a way guiding the space to be more than just a conversation, a normal conversation. It feels like an extremely specific relationship that is unlike any other relationship that one has in the world. Like, I feel like I'm constantly like, what is this relationship? Feels really bizarre.
Yeah, it's definitely unlike any other relationship. Ideally, I'm not burdening you with my own problems and emotions and thoughts and feelings about everything. So there's enough space for you to unfold in whatever way that ends up unfolding. But I'm also listening, ideally on multiple levels as well. So listening, getting lost in the content would be a sign that kind of I've taken a wrong turn somewhere, because I'm getting too caught up in the actual story versus what's not being said, the kind of the music behind the words, the slips, when the patient says something that they didn't mean to, also paying attention to the frame. So what time we meet, how often we meet, is the person canceling a lot? Is the person rescheduling? Is the person coming late? Those are all communications that are potential to be talked about.
It's interesting because to hone in on the fact that the content of what's being said isn't the most important thing, and to get carried away with that is a disservice to the therapy. And in thinking about the way that poetry works, oftentimes there's this constant push and pull between the narrative and what's not being said, and the lyrical, and the way that the words sound, and the way that the line breaks, and the choices the poet made, and how what form the poem's going to take in general, and all those things sort of taken at once create meaning that is apart from the narrative that the poet's actually saying, the story of the poem.
Right. Yeah, there's always something being communicated apart from the literal communication.
And possibly because, well, definitely because it's hard for us to even know what we're communicating.
It's impossible to know fully what we're communicating.
I was surprised to read in Philip Broomberg's essay that you sent me called Playing with Boundaries, that a primary task for the analyst's therapeutic role is to contribute to preserving the illusion that the patient's illogical wish to stay the same while changing. I think I was shocked because of the word preserving. One's immediate assumption would be that you'd have to contribute to getting them to realize that that's an impossible task, to change while staying the same.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, that's the illusion, I guess, is that you could, change while staying the same. And he has some really interesting ideas about that in terms of people don't give up their identities so easily.
Right.
That's part of preserving that illusion, because as painful as my identity might be, it's very central to my personal meaning. And so I'm not going to just kind of give that up so easily. So I need to have this illusion that I'm staying the same person while changing. And so that's why it's really important to we've kind of talked about like irony in poetry and these kind of juxtaposition of different self states. And there's a part of every patient that doesn't want to change. And the more the analyst kind of ignores that part or tries to convince them that that part's not needed, the more that part's going to kind of scream and say, wait, I don't feel like I'm being recognized here. And so, until I'm recognized, we're not going anywhere.
Interesting. It seems like a massive step in self-awareness is realizing that there's multiple selves, and there isn't one single self. And when that identity is challenged, it could be very shattering for someone. I like Broomberg's called it a sublimated version of that, to be the capacity to feel like oneself while being many. Which is kind of like, it makes me think of, so in poetry, you're taught very early as a writer in workshop to when you're talking about somebody's poem, you're talking about the speaker in the poem. You're not talking about Nathan in the poem. And that divide between, that's not me in the poem, that's the speaker, is really important. And I remember feeling, and I could see it on other people's faces too, and that when we talk about the speaker, there's a sense of relief on everybody's part to be able to distance themselves from that identity in the poem. At the same time, what is poetry but dealing with the self and not a character like you would see, say, in a story where you actually have a character with a name and an identity and a backstory and all that. Which, of course, if you're going to get in the weeds about it, those are also multiple versions of the writer's self, too, I'm sure. But I started thinking about how one way that poetry is so helpful to one's psychology is that you are able to play out multiple selves in the poem. And then also when reading poetry, place yourself within the poem as a different self. And there is a sort of relief in that, but also a relief in recognizing the self. But it's not so cut and dry, right? It's like both. Like poetry is nonfiction and fiction at the same time. It's truth, but it's not truth. So it is the perfect playing ground, I suppose, to let that be okay. In all the poems we were emailing back and forth, that is the case, I think. We should look at one. I liked this metastatic or poem. I'm not familiar with this poet, Anya Krugovoy, Russian?
I don't know. She's the sister of my advisor when I was in psychoanalytic training.
Oh, interesting. I'd like a long braid to lasso my rage away, to stand on a stage in a garter belt and thigh-high boots and stamp my feet through the floor. Like to put my face right up against someone else's face and scream until the scream knocks me to my knees coughing. I could become an arsonist, delicious click of the lighter. Every time someone I love dies, I'd like a diamond to line the hilt of a dagger or tip an arrow. I'd like to shoot the whole goddamn universe through its infinite starry center and watch it suck into itself, scattering the suns and galaxies over each other like a jar of tipped glitter. Don't tell me not to be angry. Do you know how close I am to flinging my whole body at you? How little I care about being hit back or spat on or bruised. Humiliation means nothing to me. I have nothing to lose.
Ooh. You know, so many people are not in touch with their anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, are so quick to come up with a million reasons why they shouldn't be angry.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this misconception in society that if you're angry, it's wrong. You shouldn't be angry. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of like, I think, maybe even some kind of mindfulness or spiritual ideas about that anger is bad. And so what I love about this poem is it's just kind of like, kind of unbridled embrace of one's rage and not being ashamed of it, not coming up with intellectual reasons why I shouldn't be angry, but in fact, welcoming the anger and, like you said, kind of celebrating it. There's something about that that is really moving to me. And that's what I like about poetry, is being moved.
Yeah, it's like we get to feel angry. We get to feel this anger and these possibilities. Interestingly, the poem is set up as a hypothetical expression of anger. I'd like to do this. I'd like to do X, Y, Z.
That's a good point.
I just got in an argument with my brother before this podcast about this poem. Because I was saying what you were saying, which is that we live in a world where we can't express our anger and we need to. And he was saying that's bullshit, that like we're always saying, oh, you just got to go out in a field and scream out loud. And he's like, that doesn't do anything. And then he was saying, what am I supposed to do? Just go murder somebody? And it was making him very angry. And I think he was missing the point, which is that it's almost like we don't allow ourselves to feel our own anger inside, just on a personal level. We don't need to scream out loud or anything, but I think it is 100% true that this is something I've found certainly in my journey, that there's a lot of fear around feeling anger because you're afraid of what you're going to do. Maybe you are afraid you're going to go murder somebody. But also I think just that cultural, there's this almost insidious demand in culture to be kind, to be happy, to be a good person, to be morally influential, you know, and to be a moral leader in everything you do. And it's like, it's exhausting because the anger doesn't go away on its own. It's very hard to find places to understand even how to express anger, right? So maybe what he was saying too is that, like, I don't know how to express this anger. Like, am I supposed to just go kill somebody? It may come to that if you don't figure out a way to to sort of integrate it into the self, which does make me think of like the Jungian shadow business, which is the idea that that we all these shadow selves that I'm not telling you, I'm sure you know all this, but I'm telling people that must be dealt with. Otherwise it starts acting out in more self-destructive ways. So artists a lot of times will deal with it through their art and things like that. Although I've found that that's not enough oftentimes.
Yeah, I mean, I like the point you raised about the hypothetical, and I'm just thinking about expressing anger and, you know, what's problematic about anger can be how you express your anger. And if you punch a wall and break your hand, that's not the best use of anger. Say something really hurtful to someone that you love that you can't sort of ever take back, that's really destructive.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to kind of, I don't know if you've had this experience, like in a fight with someone you love, and like those times where you are able to kind of hold on to your anger and experience it,
mm-hmm.
and like talk in a way where you're still angry, but you're getting your point across without going off the rails. Mm-hmm. There's a real aliveness and energy in feeling that anger and holding it and experiencing it. That's mm-hmm. what most people have a problem doing, is experiencing the anger. It's easy to just discharge it.
Right.
Anya's doing in this poem, she's also fantasizing about it.
Right.
Not just like discharging it. Or the other end of the spectrum is to withdraw and become passive and withholding. That's mm-hmm. also a destructive way of expressing anger. But in this poem, she's fantasizing about it and reflecting on it. And that to me is a kind of generative way of experiencing anger.
Right, because one can fantasize about it in a poem, or in therapy.
Right.
And like letting it play out without repercussions. You can be immoral and murderous in therapy.
Yes. Yeah, it's so common for patients to be reluctant to even go there.
Right, right.
No, I can't. No, I would never do anything to that.
Right.
Well, of course, this isn't a rehearsal.
Right.
But it's like, won't even go there. You know, it's like a thought crime.
Right. Right. I know that's how deep it is. I mean, it's amazing when you have this opportunity to do anything, to be as imaginative as you want. And even with that permission, you're like, I can't do that. Like there's some sort of, the thought police.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there was I keep thinking about the poet Mark Wunderlich, who said, don't be the victim or the hero in your poems. And I was like, yes, it's kind of great to be the villain sometimes, you know, to like be as awful as you, you know, this like idea that we have to like present ourselves as like the better person all the time. It makes for bad poetry. You know, it feels false too. And like what you were saying about poetry before is, you know, there is a lot of bad poetry out there. And I think it does seem to come down a lot of times to like being honest with yourself and the feelings you're having.
We're trying to read each other's minds because I'm thinking about like that is kind of like seems to be the superordinate kind of moral imperative in psychoanalysis is to try to be as honest as possible, not to be as good as possible.
Oh my God. And it's so easier said than done. I mean, it's like, wow. It's like you keep having to remind yourself, what are we here to do? We're just here to be honest. Like when you sit down to write a poem and you're trying so hard to manipulate your language in order to say things a certain way, in order to be liked, in order to be seen, because you think, I must be great to be seen. I must be beautiful and morally secure and nurturing and like, sounds smart and all these things. And it's just not, it's actually not reality, right?
Not reality.
And reality is ugly and two-sided.
Oh my God. It's so ugly and manifold. Mm-hmm. And, it's like, there's always another level of, honesty about how these like disgusting, stupid, ugly, dumb, selfish, arrogant parts about ourselves that we could go into and accept, you know, like, damn, this one too?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's so, the other big one is humiliation.
Hmm.
You know, like feeling, it's like you try, of course, everything to avoid this humiliating truth about yourself. But goddamn, do I appreciate it and when I read it in other people's poems. Like a humiliating moment in a poem, like I'm like, wow, that is so much more powerful to me that you've written that in a poem than you looking like a hero, you know, you looking like the civil servant, like. Which goes to show how much we crave to be honest.
Mm. I don't know about you, but you posted something about this on Twitter at some point about kind of like how we get to experience all these different parts of ourselves on Twitter. Do you remember that? It was about a month ago or so.
We get to experience all different parts.
Like complex variations. I forget what it was, but.
Yeah.
I feel like that, like Twitter is such an interesting place for that because sometimes I'll I'll tweet something and I'll regret it.
Oh, totally.
I'll regret what I tweeted.
Right.
And I have this moment where, like, do I delete it?
Right. Totally.
And I've been trying to just keep them up.
Oh, this is so good to hear. I can't even tell you how good it is.
It's just like, what? You know, it's like, what am I trying to do? Like, keep up this pretense of, like, this person, this self-concept I have of this, I don't know, wise, you know, I'm also just dumb, you know, average kind of guy.
Totally.
You know, sometimes I'll post things that don't fit into my aesthetic.
Right.
And, you know, it's just like, I'm just trying to keep them up, you know?
Right. Exactly. And I remember making that tweet for that very reason, because I was felt like I was going insane for a second with those feelings of like, what the hell am I trying to like present this one self to the world? Like, all this, like my Twitter bubble, like who cares? It's like, it's so abstract. Talk about non-reality. And all the shit that you know, even when you have a post that is like everybody likes, it's like, it just doesn't even, even that doesn't feel right, you know? It's just like sort of this torturous thing where you do, it's like, it's a good test. I constantly have to think of, I'm like, if I don't think of it this way, it's gonna kill me. But like, it is a good test of being like, okay, there's multiple parts of myself that I'm just gonna like throw out there. And yeah, I mean, it doesn't really mean anything about who I am as like, I guess, I mean, it does seem to all come back to like wanting to be liked and seen and, you know, validated for existing. And, you know, poets, it's similar to, you know, we take more time on publishing a poem or a book or something, but I think about that with poems all the time. And I know poets are so plagued with self-hatred and self-doubt, and then such self, you know, pride and excitement. But you're like, why am I doing this? Am I doing this to be seen, to be liked? Would I do this if it wasn't being published? Like, do I have to do this? You know, we're always like, oh, if I didn't write, I'd die. You know, poets love to say that. All those things are true, I think. But it's like, I think maybe it just comes back to that dynamic relationship where we want other people to echo back to us and to create something between two people. And I mean, like, okay, so the poem needs a reader to occur. It needs another person out there to make it real, to create with it. Otherwise, it's nothing. It just doesn't matter. It really doesn't. It's not like we're writing a record of you know, history for future civilizations to know what went down, you know?
Well, it raises the question of like kind of the ideal self, and and I'm just wondering how much of a struggle that is as a poet to kind of, when you're writing, to kind of be honest and at the same time contend with this image of the kind of poet that you want to be and you want to be perceived as, because that's certainly, you know, an issue that, you know, and I say this all the time, I try to post about it a lot, but like, you know, obviously analysts deal with the same issues every other person does. And these issues of ideals and where we actually are, and maintaining that kind of that guidance from that ideal, at the same time accepting that we're never gonna reach.
Mm-hmm. And when you say ideal and psychoanalysts, do you mean as a psychoanalyst or as like a person? Or In this context of when you're talking about it.
I guess I mean it like as a person. In my case, it would include my when I'm doing psychoanalysis.
Right, because when you picture your ideal self, you're picturing your ideal self in your profession as well.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you how, thinking so much about this ideal self, because I find it to be actually pretty damaging. Okay. Yes. You said recently, and I felt like you were reading my mind at this point, ideal self on Twitter, you said, ideal self meet actual self. I see you two have a lot to discuss. So given our culture of self-improvement and self-help and reach your highest potential and be kind and all that, like, how damaging is it actually to fantasize about an ideal self or obsess over it?
Oh, it's so damaging. It's so destructive. I mean, my first analyst, I don't know, I mean, maybe this is out there, but when he said it to me, it was original. You know, it was like, you know, the ideal self's like the North Star. You know, it's how you orient yourself, but you're not supposed to reach the North Star because you would incinerate yourself.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's so disappointing not to be this fantasied image of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So incredibly disappointing.
Yeah.
Kind of be just kind of a ordinary human, warts and all.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times people come into therapy wanting to figure out how to become their ideal self.
Right. Oh my God, it's so true.
And so again, it's not that it doesn't have a purpose or a function. It's a guidance system. But when it becomes kind of this thing that has to happen, that's when it's problematic.
It's almost like I found that it became like a manifestation of like self-harm to like fantasize about this ideal self, where I was like, just brutal, you know, like I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and just not, and knowing that it wasn't going to happen today, and then saying I was going to do it tomorrow, and just going on and on and on and on like that. It's just like eventually you like are suicidal. I mean, you know, because it's like, what? It's like some horrible hell. And it's like, what's the point? I thought, you know, like in your mind, you're thinking, when I'm this ideal self, I will be happy. Yes. Because I'll be healthy and people will like want to be around me, and I'll have the things I want to make me happy. And it's like, meanwhile, you're just completely ruining your life. It's like basically what my new book's about. It's weird because like I'm on such the other side of that era, but not really, because it keeps going back. It's very seductive.
Very
Yeah, you're like, ooh, I could like totally start working out and be like so fit. I could be like the fittest person in my friend group. I could be like, everyone would be like, holy shit, look at you, like you're amazing, and like I could win the Pulitzer Prize, and you know, it's just like and meanwhile you're not writing, you're not moving. It's like, so again, accepting reality. Not like, oh, I'm just going to accept I'm a piece of shit. It's like just seeing the fantasy for what it is and facing, maybe even what it means that you're obsessing over these things. Because they do seem like almost like a symptom of something else that you're not dealing with, like a distraction. Which I see in poetry all the time with students, you know, massive distractions in their poems. You know, you get a little teeny weeny glimpse in one line in the middle of the poem, and you're like, that was actually what the poem was about. And all this stuff around it is like a fantasy about what you want the poem to be. It's hard not to psychoanalyze people's poems. It's basically what happens in workshop. And it's always been that way. I've always, of course, nobody knows anything about, you know, the theories. They're just talking about what they see in the poems. But oftentimes it's stuff that you weren't aware of in the poem. So, right. So that's like why you have workshop, right? So you can sort of have people be like, well, this is what I'm seeing in the poem. And you're like, oh my God, I didn't mean to write a poem about my father. You know, it's like, but here it is.
Yeah. That's, that reminds me of like the, I think it's called the Joe Barry window. It's named after these two researchers, these psychology researchers, and it's just like four boxes. And there's, in the first box, it's things that you know about yourself that other people also know about you. And the next box, it's things that only you know about yourself, but other people don't. And then the third box is things that other people know about you that you don't. And then the fourth box is things neither person or nobody knows about you.
I mean, it's good to hear that and accept that. I think there's like a, there's something disappointing in thinking you know everything about yourself, and also that you know what other people think about you, when really there's all these different categories of what we know and don't know. And then, of course, thank God, this big, giant, dark space that we know nothing about, which to me is the most exciting potential.
Dark matter.
Yeah, the dark matter.
Yeah, there's this quote in this Why Poetry book that I really like.
I'm so glad.
Extreme clarity is a mystery. Mm. Are you familiar with that?
That Matthew wrote that, or was it a quote from somebody else?
Mahmoud Darwish?
Yeah.
That's such an interesting statement.
Say it again.
Extreme clarity is a mystery.
Yeah. I can see Matthew standing behind that line, because he is obsessed with clarity in his poems, and it certainly does create a strangeness in the poem.
So yeah, I was thinking of it kind of like, sort of like the other way around, of the more that mystery or strangeness can be, more receptive you can be to that strangeness and that mystery, the more space that is created for it, the more clarity there is.
That you can gain? Yeah.
Right, because you're like, having to know the answer, sort of being preoccupied with understanding why I'm like this. That can get in the way of a certain clarity, because there's no space for that kind of negative capability.
God, we haven't even gone there.
There's a lot of I think there's a lot of patience required for that.
For not knowing. Yeah. There is, and talking with my friend Leanne, who's been on the podcast before, yesterday, about trying to figure out what the fuck is this thing I need to figure out. It's driving me mad. Like, why am I like this? That seems to be it, is that trying to figure something out and have one answer. Is rather destructive and also seductive. We want answers. I think that's partly why people have a hard time with poetry, because it often doesn't have, right? It leaves so much unsaid and open for you to do the work as a reader, and certainly for the writer to honor what they don't know. And what may be known, because so there always has to be this space left in a poem to create this the mutable, changing meaning.
Space left. Space left in a poem.
But uncertainty is so uncomfortable and frightening. And sometimes I ask my Google Home a math question just so I can have an answer. It's like completely meaningless, but there's this sense of like wanting an answer. It doesn't even matter. It's why it can be so dangerous to follow people who say they have the answer.
Yes. And so seductive. Cults really feed off of that already inherent desire to merge with the ideal self, and the cult offers you that promise.
Let's read a poem. I want to read this Natalie Shapiro poem. She is incredible at negative capability. This poem is called Winter Injury, and it's from her book, Hard Child. Burn from a worsted rug that will not display for a full day, welcome home. Right off the bat, it's like, whoa, I'm disoriented, but I still feel very grounded in the fact that it's a rug. All I have, I'll start over, burn from a worsted rug that will not display for a full day, welcome home. All I have coming in this world is a joke that hits me later. I was never the hampered child, doting on what could not feel, unwilling to walk on stairs that creaked for fear it hurt the house. I never knew a thing about crying out, when to run, when to come running, when to run, how, as with the lowing of a simpler species, pain is the body's way of making meaning. My old love handled me hard, and I thought nothing. Yesterday, I happened across a killed cat on the road. Someone had hit it. It was then I wondered, could that be me? Am I the cat cut down from the world for hours now, oblivious, seeing myself only as a witness? I went to touch the body, but was afraid, afraid of my own body and what disease I carry in death. I remembered meeting a child at a funeral. She could recite all the times an animal escaped from a zoo enclosure. I remembered, I am no cat. hardly wild as to require a wall, but instead a bird dog falling in snow, splaying, pulling up, bearing in my mouth some little trauma like a pheasant, blood in the feathers and me, bread never to break the skin. Again, I resolve to move. A woman lists a near room in a floor through with piano. I have no use for any box of hammers, but still I reply, having been raised as though in a family of weavers, where it falls on the youngest ones to watch for faults. The young among us traffic in the ragged, dinner sonatinas, seldom the rage. My old love handled me hard. I let it happen. The songs I like are mostly swears and clapping.
How much of that poem is something that you get on a psychological level versus a intuitive, nonverbal level?
Well, I feel like the psychological level is also the intuitive level, isn't it?
I guess I'm referring to kind of a conscious cognitive level.
Mm-hmm.
This is a felt sense of the poem.
Yeah, I mean, this is a poem where I feel I understand it, but I couldn't retell it back to you. It's interesting because it's something that's made of words and it's dealing with intense emotion, but you can't speak it back. You couldn't even speak a single emotion back. Or at least you can speak one emotion back. So I would say the latter. Two things. One is that certain things are so hard to talk about directly. Maybe even because you feel like saying them plainly doesn't do them justice or something, like it's bigger than what it sounds like when you say it plainly. Well, Matthew would disagree with that. But two, that the mind speaks in metaphors. And our experiences speak in metaphors inside us. And when we try and fit them into some prosaic information-giving machine, that it's not going to be getting at all the subtleties of human experience. So in a way, poetry is poised to give honestly the narrative of an experience in how the mind processes it. Because I would say that the mind works in a way that is non-linear and spontaneous, and things that you wouldn't think go together happen together in our mind, much like a dream. When you're like, what the hell was that dream? Mm-hmm. But it's hard to accept that type of information. Because it's not how we're taught to take in information. So I think one can get a little scared about what's being said instead of simply feeling it or letting the poem happen to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a real challenge for people who are new to therapy, specifically psychoanalytic therapy, is to stop relying on the rational mind so much. It's very scary to consider that there might be other reasons why you're showing up late, which doesn't happen so much that we're working remotely for whatever reason. But showing up late or whatever kind of certain behavior that's being enacted, that there could be whatever rational reason, it's plausible, but there might be another reason that is not so plausible and is irrational. And could we entertain that possibility, just like we were talking about before, sort of entertaining the fantasy of the anger or the rage? Could we entertain the fantasy that there could be something that we're not conscious of that's operating inside us?
It's interesting because I don't think you wouldn't say that to somebody, would you? You would wait for them to, would you say like, oh, is there something that's not consciously happening here?
I mean, it depends. I mean, if someone is continually like refusing to sort of entertain that possibility, I might give some psychoed, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we don't have to be so worried about being rational in here. We can actually, this is a place where we can sort of make room for irrationality and see what's there, because it's going to be harder to get at things kind of straight on in a kind of conscious way. So any chance we get to kind of use some kind of unconscious communication, that could be helpful to us.
Well, like thinking as we wrap up here, about the bigger picture, like who cares about going to therapy, writing poems? Like, is it just like a curiosity, you know, or is it just something to do on the side, you know? Obviously I don't believe that, but why is it important? Like, I feel like I care so much about poetry. I now care so much about thinking about psychoanalysis and telling people about what I can see it doing. But in the larger sense of our culture, what do you think, is it being utilized enough? And if it, what would happen if it did? Would it be good?
I mean, I have like mixed feelings about it. Sometimes I see like people talking about, you know, everyone having access to therapy. And then I think, well, what's wrong with our society where like, you know, like everyone's in therapy. Great.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's that side of it. But also I think it's so, I want it to be more accessible to people because it so goes against the grain of our society, which is to be reflective, to try to be as honest with yourself as possible, which is both scary and enlivening, to develop that kind of playful curiosity you had as a child, to use your imagination, to develop a very deep, special relationship with someone that's unlike any other relationship you'll have in your life. You know, I was just going to say, and the, you know, the other side of it is also too, like, it doesn't matter. You know, I just, so many people, I think I looked this up, like how many people have come and gone. Like these, I think it's like 75 billion people have been on Earth and died, and we'll have our like little grand designs about what we're going to do with our life and stuff. And like so many people have had these same thoughts, you know, oh, I'm going to do this, you know, one day, and they died, and that will happen to us too.
I know, like you hear about these huge civilizations that just dominated, that are just dust now. Like we don't even know anything about them at all. And they were once like us. Probably not as global, but that's true. There's a comfort in that as well. You know, we'll all be dust And why worry? But then there's this sort of like metaphysical, you know, sentimental even idea of like, oh, we're part of something bigger, and like consciousness is like bigger than the body, you know, it's bigger than this physical form and our things that we make, that, you know, matter, that we can see, that there's this, God, I feel like suddenly really emotional about it, but like, there's this feeling that when you're writing poetry, when you're talking about human psychology, that it is pointing towards God or something. Like it's pointing towards like some sort of bigger, you know, I keep bringing this up, and I'm so sorry, anybody who's crazy enough to listen to all the episodes, that like that fucking planetarium, you were there, that planetarium thing really affected me for whatever reason that day, that I do hope that somehow consciousness and the way we think, words, communication, feelings, all those things are larger than this corporeal form, this dead cat in the street.
I'd like to think so as well. And that there's like this kind of like, you know, whatever we're talking about, that there's some kind of invisible laws of the universe that we're not aware of. I'm all about that.
I mean, I think we can certainly agree we know such a little tiny corner of what's going on with life. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad that even in our brief time on this earth, in the grand scheme of time, that we can write poems and sit in rooms with one another and think thoughts together.
And meet people online and end up developing friendships.
I know. Actually, I know, it's like I was researching something early on last year, came across James Barnes's article and tracked him down on Twitter. Never done that before, but that started my whole Twitter life, and through him found you. So I am extremely grateful for Twitter in these ways.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, I know this won't be the last time we talk. I feel we're just warming up, but I want to thank you for your time, sir, and for your work.
Thank you for having me. It was so fun to be.